And we are back, Bob Metz, Jeff Schlemmer, just slipping on the headphones here and putting on the body armor, and we're going to get to left, right, and center in just a moment or two. Let me just do this here, and then I don't have to remember to do it later. Okay, I've done that. Gentlemen, good morning to you. Nice to see you both today.
And you.
Same to you, Jim.
We were just talking here about a few minutes ago about principle. I'm going to ask you a little bit about principle in government. There's a story out of Duluth, Minnesota, of a guy on the county board who, in a heated debate, heated argument, someone had said, well, and it was about, it doesn't matter what the issue was, the other issue was about. Somebody said, well, if the, he said, the majority of my people support me. He said, if the majority of your people supported slavery, would you support it too? And he said, if my constituents wanted that, yes, I would. And there was a bit of an outcry against that, as you might imagine. And he has since apologized insofar as he said he's a diabetic and hadn't eaten yet, and so he wasn't thinking clearly. But my first job is to represent my constituents, and that's the point I was trying to make. And the observation I offered was that I think there are some things that are absolutes in this world, and I think anti-slavery is one of them. I don't believe there is any excuse for it, and I don't think that if everybody else on the planet thought it was a good idea and you thought it wasn't a good idea, I don't think you should conform to that. I think that's one of those things where you draw the line. If you're an elected representative where you would say, well, if that's what you want, then get somebody else because I'm not doing this job. I want to ask you fellas what you think about that, the position that he took, that even though he personally thought it was reprehensible and did not support slavery, he made that very clear in his explanation later on. He kept coming back to, but I have a job to represent my constituents.
Then he should never run if that's his belief and his constituents believe something else. And he should run on a position of what he believes. Because if that's what he's there to represent. But, you know, the idea that you're there to represent your constituents, I think, is a blurring of a very important distinction. And I have never in my life approached politics as a politician representing me as my interests. You should be representing the individual rights of your constituents. Mm-hmm. You should be making sure that they're all equal before and under the law. That's the job of a representative in government. Not to represent my interests, but to represent my rights.
And yet the average person doesn't
justice.
See it that way. The average person, their rights
and
are their interests.
As a consequence, they are losing their rights at the expense of people's interests. You haven't got a right to even subscribe to the cable company you want because the government protects certain interests in the country from you having that choice, right? And you can build upon that million examples until finally you have what you call a totalitarian state. And that's what is always the end result of a society that actually moves toward majority rule. Read any book on democracy, and it'll tell you that when democracy collapses into simple majority rule, which, by the way, is what the new democracy is all about. And that's majority rule. That's what the NDP is about, pure democracy. And by meaning majority rule, whereas real democracy means that the source of the government's power is in the people themselves. That's all it means. It doesn't prescribe a specific electoral system or this or that. It just means that the ruler is of the same legal stature as the citizen that is being ruled, quote, you know.
Jeff, when you hear a story like this about this guy and making a comment and then afterwards sort of explaining, well, I was off my meds and I shouldn't have said it, but I have a responsibility to my constituents. What do you make of that?
I think that nobody should ever say but, particularly when you're apologizing. And from the initial description, it sounds like, you know, he said something, and I myself have to be careful about getting into rhetorical flourishes and then trying to argue, well, technically what I was saying was right and all that stuff. You know, it's fine for him to have sort of gone off the deep end on something. And I think that politicians, though, where they go wrong is that they just find it so hard to just apologize and leave it at that. And, you know, not knowing this guy, I can't speak, but it would seem to me that he probably regretted having said it and probably wouldn't have said it if he didn't feel that, if he hadn't gone overboard. But once having done it, to me, you can't give a qualified apology. It has to be an abject apology and say, I was a doughhead and it was wrong, and I totally retract it without qualification. And as soon as somebody starts to say any kind of qualifier to it, then it's it's seen as not sincere. So as far as the substance of what he said, it's clearly wrong, and clearly it is the case that it's great to say that I want to represent my constituents, but that doesn't mean that you test the wind, and if they decide that they want to murder babies or something, that you're going to think that's a good idea and support it. Obviously, you can only take... I'm going to pursue what the people want so far. The other aspect of that is that the people, reminding me of the Rolling Stones, you know, you can't always get what you want, but sometimes you can get what you need. People don't always know what they need, and a lot of being a leader, I would argue, in politics is helping people to understand things so that they can make informed decisions. Somebody was talking recently about how maybe there should be a law that we can't go to war without a referendum, for instance. And my initial thought to that was, but at the time when countries get into wars, there's usually a time of heated rhetoric, inflamed passions, and so on, and demagogues can whip the majority into pretty well whatever they want. So I don't know that that would be a really good safety check. If anything, that could go the other way, I think, and make politicians more likely to get into bad situations. I was listening last night to a program talking about John F. Kennedy and the Cuban Missile Crisis and how he recorded most of the cabinet meetings because he had been reading Barbara Tuchman's book, The Guns of August, mm-hmm. about how World War I started, and that after the war they asked the German, it wasn't the chancellor, but senior politician anyway, how this happened. How did you get into this war? And he said, I have no idea. And that Kennedy was determined that not happen if things blew up in Cuba. And I think it's the same kind of danger that things can spin out of control, and that's where politicians aren't just there to take to test the temperature of the electorate. They're there to demonstrate leadership.
Let me ask you both a question about things spinning out of control. I read a story this morning, and it's not the first story along these lines, a bit of fear-mongering, but the Cold War is back. Vladimir Putin is on the outs with the United States. They're going to ramp up their nuclear program. They're going to send all their boomers to the North Pole, all their nuclear subs to the North Pole, where they'll be undetectable, their missile subs. They're going to improve their nuclear capability, yada, yada, yada. The Cold War is back, folks. And
it never left.
Well, I thought about what occurred to me was I remember very clearly after the fall of the wall when Russia was in disarray, but politically seemed to be very inclined towards the West. And I remember very clearly, it was a cold winter's night walking down the street, and I don't know why I remember this or why I thought it at the time, but just isn't it nice that after however many years, 30, 40 years, I guess, of my life lived under this nuclear cloud, I have some sense that maybe it's not inevitable. Maybe nuclear war is not going to be what ends my life, and isn't that a wonderful, liberating thing, and the world has ducked a bullet on this one. And here we are some years later. And I don't disagree with what you said, Bob, that it didn't really go away. But certainly we had a hope, perhaps. We had an opportunity for it to go away. And then you look at the other things that have changed politically during that period of time. You look at 9/11, right after 9/11, and the incredible sense of purpose that the Americans have had as a nation, and how that's been frittered away. And you can blame it on George or Cheney or anybody you want, but I don't care who's to blame. It's that this is a pattern that we see recurring over and over again in history, where things do seem to slip out of anybody's control. And Barbara Tuchman's book is something that everyone should read, Guns of August. It's a remarkable, brilliant work. And you know, at the end of it, you are left sitting there going, what for? There are tens of millions of people dead, and for what? We didn't eliminate tyranny. We didn't do anything except really slaughter tens of millions of people.
Well,
how does that happen? How do these things get out of control?
We didn't eliminate tyranny as a consequence of World War I or II either. It still exists.
Mm-hmm.
All we did and all we can do at any given point in time is defend what we do have.
But we weren't doing that in World War I.
Well,
economically, no, maybe, but even that's a
understood.
Threat.
But in the general sense, in the principle sense, that's what you're going over to fight wars for, to defend yourself. Yeah. That's where I think the whole Iraq war got offline. They wanted to democratize a country that has no history of democracy and can't even play democracy. You could make all the laws you want democratically, it isn't going to take, mm-hmm. right? So, and that they don't understand that is beyond me. But nevertheless, the world is always going to be in the state it is as long as there's this constant battle between freedom and totalitarianism. And there's only one side to blame.
Yeah, but the battle, you know? No, but you're ducking the question here. The battle is not about well, maybe
government control versus individual choice.
Is that why things slide out of control?
Always. History is.
Well, who were the totalitarians in World War I?
In government control, they were trying to control the economy. It was the same thing, you know.
I thought it was about alliances. I recall that it was.
Yeah, alliances and trade barriers. You know, Frederick Bastiat, the great French economist of 1850, you know, he warned socialist quote of all parties that he says when goods don't flow across borders, armies will.
But there's a rebuttal to that because there was an incredible flow of goods across all of the borders in Europe before World War One. This is a misconception that's grown up since.
Yeah, I'm not saying that's the only reason that a war would start. Don't get me wrong, but it's one of the major ones. And you see the same. Even look at Canada. Canada is fighting amongst itself. We're not shooting at each other yet. Okay, it's a political war, and how instead of using bullets, we use money. We get robbed by Quebec for their interest. It's a complete. How did Ayn Rand used to put it? You know, you've got pressure groups and lobby groups, which is a consequence of that majority rule system that we're under. Basically, politics is about robbing Peter to pay Paul. That's what modern politics is. It's not about statesmanship
diplomacy. Again, how do things slide out of control? How is it that the best, the best and brightest among us can get us into fixes like World War One?
Who's the historian that said that when the citizenry gets a hold of the treasury, it's all over? You know? And that's generally what happened from Rome on down when they were great citizen or great civilizations. In relative terms, of course, they collapsed when the citizenry got hold of the treasury. And
in World War One, essentially, it was the Austro-Hungarian Empire who brought in the Germans against the Russians. I don't know if that there was really a philosophical difference between the Tsar and the Kaiser, for instance. I don't know that their governments were all that different. You know, they were essentially modern.
Well, they were both totalitarian in my sense of looking, but
they were fighting each other.
Exactly, and that's quite normal. You see people on the right fighting people on the right because they see each other as almost a greater enemy than the left because they figure, oh, we should be united, you know? And so you'll see all this infighting going on all the time, and that's all.
But there's always the fear in World War One. You can, if you look to find what happened, one of the major issues was a fear that somebody else was going to get the march on you. Somebody was going to get a step ahead of you. Somebody was going to expand Russia. The Germans were concerned about the future of Russia. It was this vast, incredibly
and
huge
they also
country
believed
that was going to overwhelm them eventually.
Yes, and they believed that the future depended upon land acquisition. Very much that was in the philosophy of the whole German thinking, even into the Second World War. And the idea that you didn't need to do that, that it was trade and industrialization that would take care of the travel part itself. You don't need to go and possess everything, you know. So
I guess the main thing that strikes me about it, and I think that people sometimes get the idea that somehow we're smarter than the guys were then that were running things, or that we're running things in ancient Rome, for instance. And I don't know that there's any empirical evidence that our IQ points have gone up. And I look at people back at that time. I'm rereading a biography of Teddy Roosevelt right now, and he loved Germany, and he spent a couple of years there when he was growing up. He spoke German, you know, and he's the president of the United States at the turn of the century. And they talked about how there was so much intermingling consciously done in the late 1800s. And, of course, the Kaiser was a grandson of Queen Victoria, for instance, and was a full admiral of the British Navy and so on, that the ambassadors from France, Germany, and England in the United States at that time all had American wives, and that again, they purposely tried to globalize themselves by having all this intermarriage going on, having relations that, again, the royal families were all related in Europe. And they had 40 years of essential peace between them, I guess, before it flew apart. And it really does seem like it just flew apart for reasons that are now hard to discern, and that certainly had nothing to do with an absolute good versus evil. And at the end of the day, you know, we spent a fair bit of time, my kids and I, talking about Vimy this past week, and what was that about, and what was World War One about, and so on. And it's really hard to explain.
You know, good and evil, the effects of them are not a matter of intention. Often the terrible things that are happening in the world could be intended as being good by the people who perpetrated them or who ended up starting the ball rolling.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people have good intentions when, for example, domestically, they think that we need a government-run healthcare system, okay, because that's the only way they can linearly think that that's the way we're going to get everybody's going to be taken care of, even though evidence shows the contrary. And yet, that nice intention can hurt a lot of people, kill some people, and it can create a conflict between the people who see it differently and are not being given their way of living according to their judgment by their minds, because somebody else has made up their mind that you're going to live the way I think you should live. And that's the constant problem with the world from top to bottom, is some people telling others how to spend their life.
On that thought, we'll be right back.
Love him or hate him, you can't live without him. Jim Chapman on 94.9 FM CHRW.
Where were we? I've lost the thread here, guys.
Well, we were talking about
the Cold War.
Whether it's back. I guess let me say this about that, if I may. I was startled for some reason watching a commercial not too long ago about some financial company, and you may have seen it, where they're looking at some guys who are testing snow tires in Finland.
Yes.
And talking about, 5 million population, makes no sense. And he looks across the lake and goes, Russia, 180 million people. We can sell our tires there. And I thought, geez, Russia's down to 180 million. How can they ever be taken seriously again? So I'm thinking the U.S. is over 300 million on its own, leave alone Western Europe and so on. And I'm thinking, you know, Russia has had its day. Like, it had enough parts lopped off.
But they don't like that. That's the problem.
And that's fine. But realistically, Russia is so heavily in debt now to the West. They're so heavily intermixed with the West. They're so heavily wanting to sell their oil and so on to the West that they can bluff and bluster if they like. But realistically, the States is not going to let them build a bunch of new nuclear submarines. It's just not going to happen.
How are they going to stop them? And they're not broke. They've got incredible potential revenues from that oil, and they don't have to sell it to the Americans at all. The Chinese would love to buy it.
Yeah,
Europe wants to buy it.
For what was supposedly under the USSR an industrialized economy, their industry is in a real mess, and it's great that they've discovered oil, but that doesn't suddenly rebuild their infrastructure. It doesn't make them a functional society, I don't think.
I think it will if there's enough money there.
Maybe
not a functional society, but certainly will allow them to rebuild their military-industrial complex. There's lots of money for that.
Yeah, I just don't think the States is going to let them. And again,
that gets back to slavery, Jim. If you have a slave society, sure, you can create in a very small, narrow niche, something productive.
Which
maybe
is what
maybe you could send a man to the moon, build
Soviet
a military,
did, yes.
but leave everybody else starving.
Yeah.
That's where
the danger is with China. China are the guys who are on the ascendant.
I agree.
The ones are up and coming. So they're the guys to worry about. And historically, they haven't gotten along very well with Russia, even when they were ostensibly communist.
Here's a question for you. And this is, how do we analyze this? I don't know. Everybody, I think, every serious geopolitical scientist I know agrees with you and me that China is the potential problem, and China is really what the anti-ballistic missile deal is all about. They're not worried about an occasional missile coming from North Korea or Iran. They're worried about China.
Yep.
They're worried about China, a Chinese leader at one point sometime in the future saying, just want to let you know we're taking over Taiwan tomorrow, and the American president says, no, you're not, and the Chinese president says, yes, we are. What are you going to do about it?
They interposed the 7th Fleet, as they've always threatened to do. But at the end of the day, you're right. Eventually, that becomes a pretty credible threat. And
yep.
China's got all kinds of very nice weapons.
Sure. They say, tell you what we're going to do. We'll take out San Diego. Well, we'll take out Shanghai. Well, be our guest.
Yeah, I know.
And then we'll take out San Francisco. How many cities do you want to trade?
I think that's where the future conflict really lies.
Exactly. There's no American president who wants to face that. And we shouldn't want any American president to have to face that choice either.
No, and I guess the theory has been, informally at least, that we're buying them off with capitalism, that everything we buy now is made in China, from Apple computers to they haven't really got into the cars yet, but that's coming very soon.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, the theory, I guess, is that one reason we haven't gone hard on them with human rights, well, the first thing is that there's not that much we can do about it, but the second is that if we colonize them with capitalism, that essentially communism, the support for communism, will die, and that the totalitarian government will fall as well, that following capitalism comes democracy. People who become affluent will require the right to have a bigger say in their lives through voting.
Well, that's lovely if that works, but fascism,
yes.
Fascism also
is the most popular.
Well, it rewards industry and,
yep.
and you know, can create, can function in a prosperous, can create and function in a prosperous society, but it's, do you want to live on? No.
And again, I think that's where the danger is of history repeating and not learning lessons from it, because I think that the more we can intermingle economies, the better in terms of making it much harder for a government to decide to not let that happen. For instance, if you've got China hugely dependent on exports as they're becoming for their industrial goods, it makes it harder for them to thumb their nose at the people they're selling all this stuff to. But on the other hand, that was the case in the 1800s, you know, that the European economies were very, very heavily intermixed, and they still got themselves into a huge war. And again, we're no smarter now than they were then.
It's an irony when you look at it objectively, even from the craziest totalitarian's point of view. You'd think that if he was really interested in prosperity, money, and wealth, and all those things that you think would motivate a person in power, that war would never be a consideration, because it doesn't serve anybody's interests in that regard.
Unless you're afraid, unless you're afraid that the guy around the corner does want it and does.
Well, that's self-defense is a separate matter. I'm talking about China's point of view.
Yeah,
we're looking at them as the aggressor.
The
I don't see the United States
offense,
or Canada
though.
Attacking them. And the idea that they think we ever would is an ideological one.
Maybe they don't think that.
Well, I don't think they do either, but some people do. But my point being that if you're killing people through nuclear war and stuff like that, you're destroying two things. You're destroying the productive base that you need to create wealth, and you're destroying your market that you can sell, sell to.
Yes, but your ideology will prevail. Your idea, the last man standing will be waving your flag.
Well, and that's a sign of a very sick, sick person.
But
and it's people like that that rule so much of the world, and it boggles my mind that the good people of the world put up so much with the bad people. You don't fight it by going to war with them and stuff. You do it by not sanctioning it anymore, by not making excuses,
What would you do with China today?
In what sense?
What would you do with China?
Well,
are we doing the right thing with them, as Jeff says, to try to co-opt them through
capitalism? You try to, yes, absolutely. You use diplomacy, you use trade, and you carry a big stick.
What point is the stick? What are you going to do with the stick?
When the other guy uses his, and then you got one to hit back with.
One thing about China, though, is that they have among the most aggressive population control programs of any country. And you'd think that if a country was out for global domination, the last thing they want to do is limit your population growth. You know, the population growth we're seeing in the world is in Africa and India, in countries, in places that we don't see as a threat to us. And yet that's where all this growth is happening. China, what is it? You get one, two kids? I can't remember.
One kid,
yeah.
One kid, period.
Yeah, and again, that would seem antithetical to a goal of becoming more dominant.
Except that you have to, in China's case, you have to feed those people.
Right.
And if you are at war, it becomes very problematic to do that. I mean, where's your breadbasket? The Ukraine
is
a long way away.
It's because you're trying to control production from the center, and you can't feed millions and millions of people, you know, using plan A or plan B or a five-year plan. You've got to have a million plans, yeah. One for each person. They'll leave them alone, let them do their own thing.
But having said that, although things can go sideways very quickly, no question about it, I think that your sense after the Berlin Wall fell that things were getting safer for us for the first time in my life anyway is still correct, and that we obsess about wars that are going on that are bad wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but these are microscopic conflicts compared to the ones that took up most of the 20th century.
Good point. Gentlemen, we're almost out of time, and it would be remiss of me, because this is the last time that we'll get together to do this, not to thank each of you for the last, has it been 10 years we've been doing this?
Jim, we started. I got checked the date.
I knew Bob would know this.
September 10, 1997.
Wow.
So it's 07.
We're close to 10 years. I just want to thank the two of you for the tremendous contributions you've made to this program and the delight and joy that you've brought into my life week after week after week. And I don't say that lightly. It's absolutely true. One of the great highlights of my radio career has been the Left, Right, and Center with you two fellas. And we've had a lot of fun, I think, over the years. I know we've stimulated a tremendous amount of thought among our audience, which is what we were all about. I know it wasn't easy for you guys always to make it to the program, and I always appreciated the effort that you put in. And I just want to say the thank you from me and from our audience, too, because I know that they're going to miss Left, Right, and Center as much as or more than anything else they've likely been listening to here on the NewsHour. So thank you both. Very, very much.
Well, thank you, Jim. And, you know, I think it's been fun for both of us.
Yep.
Even aside from Left, Right, and Center, I think you're leaving the air is kind of weird. I always saw your show as an oasis out there for radio, for considered thought, even if I didn't agree with it all the time, you know. You always knew you didn't just get the superficial you know, tip of the iceberg. You got a little bit lower there, even if you didn't like what you saw. But, I mean, I think I know a lot of people are going to miss you off the air, just in general terms. And it's been a terrific ride. I've certainly learned a lot. I've got a chance to talk to people through your show. I got to even talk to Paul Martin, and I met Pierre Burton coming out of your office one day. I like him, believe it or not. And so, anyways, it's been fun. I'm sure our paths will cross again
I look forward to that.
No question. I've told you more than once that I first heard of you through my dad, who was listening to you, who said that the great thing was that you always let the other guy have a say, that you never shut people up. And I've always really respected that. And it really is about thinking about things and trying to get to the bottom of them. And I really enjoyed this too. And I've enjoyed the chance to come out and have my beliefs tested every week. It's terrific intellectual exercise.
Well, so. I think one of the great things too of this segment of the program has been that we have illustrated that people with divergent, sometimes widely divergent political opinions can still get along, can still respect and admire and be quite fond of one another. And I think that's a lesson that we cannot stress too much in the world today.
Well, I agree.
Yeah, for sure. Big time.
I'm going to push this button here. The boys hit the music, and that leads us out. We thank again Bob Metz and Jeff Schlemmer for 10 years of support and help on here. I'm just so appreciative of that.
If you've enjoyed this presentation, visit justrightmedia.org for more programming that's not right-wing. It's just right.